let's talk and let's laugh, cause I got so much to tell you, so let's go kick some art, go kick some.
Kia ora, and welcome to Kick Arts with Emma and Steven. Kick Arts is Aotearoa's comprehensive art show brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcast, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz or find us on Spotify. Tonight, we are joined by author Nick Scullion-Dayers before we zoom across the globe to catch up with two amazing musical theatre performers, educators and practitioners. So, to kick off the show though, our friend Emerson has dropped a new track, and here is Again.
I just wanna be with you so bad, and I can't, and it's making me sad. Think about you over and over and over and over.
Again. So, it's just me in the studio today. No Stephen. And I'm hoping you can hear me because our headsets don't seem to be working. So, hopefully, well, fingers are going up and down. So, I'm pretty sure you can. I'm going to take my headsets off and fingers crossed. But anyway, it's me. Stephen is away at a conference and leaving me by myself, which actually is kind of new to have me here by myself. But anyway, I'm not totally by myself because I'm joined by an author and actor who's been on the show before, so not first time caller, but welcome to the show, Nick.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back. It's about 18 months after my my first appearance with you, so I'm very grateful to for the invite.
Yeah, it's great. So tell us, you've brought out this book, Remodeling Murder. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it is a locked room mystery. Some people may know it as a closed circle mystery, made very popular by John Dixon Carr back in the day. And the concept actually, specifically for these books, is quite simple. It is a dead body in a locked room, an impossible mystery that needs to be solved by the detective or the amateur sleuth. In my case, it is a police inspector. And the audience is presented with clues as the police inspector is presented with them. And the fun of the read is that you know exactly what the problem is, And you have to solve it at the same time as the detective, and the detective does the classic, gets everybody into the room at the end of the story and does the reveal, and the question is, can the reader get there before the detective reveals who, how and why they did it?
Okay, that's quite different. Tell us, what made you decide to do it that way and not just a book that people read through to the end?
Well, you do read through to the end. It is a normal cozy crime mystery book.
Mm-hmm.
But it has this very central puzzle.
Right.
And the older I get, when I was younger, I used to read all these exotic Latin American Isabella Allende books and... But as I get older, I find myself more and more drawn towards mysteries. I love a page turner, and a page turner to me is something that poses a question.
Right.
So why did this happen? How did this happen? And who?
Mm.
So the game Cluedo is exactly the thing. The game Cluedo, you're going around, you're trying to piece. So I found myself more and more drawn to that style of reading. And I've written all my life. I've had a couple of literary agents in London. I've gone through YA fantasy. I've gone through comedy, what you'd call dad lit, very Nick Hornby style. And I just found myself gravitating more towards this kind of puzzle-solving fiction, which I enjoy writing because you can set up a puzzle to begin with.
Mm.
So there's the kind of the challenge yourself of going, okay, I'm going to have an impossible puzzle, I'm going to write my way out of it.
I am just loving listening to you talk. There's all these kind of, obviously, literary nuances, genres, names, you know,
yes.
Like even you saying a cozy mystery or, you know, obviously YA is a young audience.
Young adult, absolutely.
The different things, you know, it's quite cute. And I suppose if you're working in that world, you learn all the in things to cool things.
Exactly. one of the benefits to the reader, but actually the authors don't like it very much, is that publishing houses want to pigeonhole. They want to say, what kind of book is this? It's a romance. It's a fantasy. It's a young adult book, or it's literary fiction, or all of these pigeonholes. And then they... literally, people will know where to put it on a shelf in a bookshop. And that's really what they're doing. They're creating these names, and each name has certain tropes within the genre. You have to have, for instance, I'm making this up a little bit at the moment, but a romance book has to have a kiss on page 30, you know, and then it has to have a little bit more intense emotion. Then they have the highs and lows. So you have little tropes within there, and then the publishing houses and the agents who are selling it know what to do with it. But I think the reader likes books that kind of bounces a little bit between genres and blurs the boundaries between it. So there is a lot of, I wouldn't say romance, but there's unrequited love runs as a theme through this. And I really wanted to give each of the characters in this a very deep backstory.
There has to be, it's like a soap opera, isn't it?
Exactly.
There needs to be lots of subplots and things going on.
Exactly, there has to be lots of subplots. Now, I wrote a book a few years back, and the publisher said it was lovely, except for the characters didn't know each other. So it's much more difficult to create. It's like a soap opera where a pub full of people had never met before.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden, the famous one, Agatha Christie, and then there were none, which Shoreside actually did this year. It's a very famous murder mystery, the most famous of all. They don't know each other, but they have a common theme, which they discovered through the play. But the publishers didn't like that style so much. They said, so you need to create something where everybody knows each other so you can create a rich backstory. So a lot of the book is about giving the backstory, and then the reader is going to work out, okay, there's a failed romance here, or there's a budding infatuation over here, or here is a financial crime, or here is some ransom, or some drug issues, or some organized crime. And they all blend in as different threads, and you have to unpick which thread you think is the most likely one that's going to give you the murder suspect at the end.
Are there times through the book that the readers are going to be, I know who did it, and it's not that person?
I hope so.
Or is that a giveaway?
No, I absolutely hope so. That's exactly what I want. So my beta readers, and I've given it out to a few individuals. It's not released till Monday morning, actually. So the 23rd is the official release date. So I all through the writing, I was giving it out to beta readers. And one of the great conversations is stopping them. A third of the way through, go, who do you think did it? You know, where do your suspicions lie now? And all the way through, people are bouncing between, I know how it's done, and I know who did it, and, you know, I know why they did it. And excuse me.
It's all right.
Excuse me.
No worries. Quite hot in the studio tonight, I must say.
So it is possible to work out. Excuse me. It is possible to work out who did it. But so far nobody's actually got to the right solution.
Well, that's always a good thing then, because that is going to be the turning point. You keep turning the page because you want to find out. So that's probably what's meant to happen?
Yes, exactly. So I very much hope that all the way through, people will suspect each of the individual characters. It's a fairly close circle group of individuals. There's only, I think, 7 potential suspects. And all the way through, I am trying to throw out incriminating evidence against each one of them.
That's so very exciting. Now, you, as people can probably tell, you have a British accent, and you mentioned before that you'd written over there. So I think we talked about this last time you came on when you were here as an actor, not as a writer. So tell us, what brought you to Aotearoa?
Well, actually, I came via Tokyo. So I was in Tokyo for 15 years, and I have 2 daughters. My wife is from New Zealand. She's from Gisborne. And we have 2 daughters, and we wanted to get them into the education system here. So we came out of Tokyo, and we moved on to the North Shore, and my eldest now, so this was 4 years ago, my eldest now has gone to Canterbury University, she's been there for a year, and my youngest is now in her final year of school at Criston on the in Albany, mm-hmm. and she hopefully is going to go to Christchurch University as well. So we're kind of creating a little family tradition. My wife did law at Christchurch University, and then we're putting the kids through the same the university school. We wanted to stay close to them, so we came from New Zealand to them.
So does that mean if they're both next year going to be in Canterbury, does that mean a potential shift for you and your wife, or would you stay here and let them have a little bit of time in the South Island?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it. For the last 10 years, I have been a stay-at-home husband, a stay-at-home father, mm-hmm. As a dad. I stopped working in Tokyo to look after our kids because we had no family, we had no support network there, and they were being raised by lovely, lovely individuals, but they were Filipino maids and people that they had no family connection to us. So for the last 10 years, I have stopped working, and I've been writing and raising my kids. And all of a sudden, I'm faced with this potential empty nest in about 9 months' time.
Does that mean, though, that maybe there's more books on the horizon and you could fill up the gap with writing?
That is absolutely my plan, yeah. So this is a Detective Inspector Pat Hand book 1. Your listeners will see if they go and look at the book that it's actually subtitled. It's Remodeling Murder, but it's subtitled D.I. Pat Hand, Book 1. Book 2 is already in the works. I'm already sitting down writing out the skeleton, the draft mm-hmm. idea. The first thing we have to do is to make the mystery. I want to keep on writing these locked room mysteries. That's going to be my calling card, if you like, now.
So is the future ones just the same detective but not the same characters, or any of the characters going to kind of carry on through?
No, it will be the same detective. There's a series of individuals. It's set in Tunbridge Wells in Kent, where I grew up for the latter part of my life, a latter part of my childhood. So it's set around the police station there, and the local pathologist, and the detective sergeant who helps Pat Hound. And there's a group of individuals who will carry through from book to book, and they have their own life beyond simply the crime. They have romantic involvements, they have issues to overcome, they have struggles with their parents, and so on and so forth. One of them is going through a divorce. And that will move from book to book.
Yep.
So the reader will be, hopefully, engaged with these individuals and wanting to know how they manage to successfully work out the threads of their own lives.
Mm.
And at the same time, each book, people will be presented with a new locked room mystery.
Now, this does make me feel like, if you've got these characters, are these characters that maybe could transfer to the stage? Is this something that could be turned into a play or into a mini series in itself on TV?
So one of my inspirations, I'm not sure if you know it, is was the movie Knives Out.
Right.
Which is very much the same kind of quirky, odd characters in a confined environment and a puzzle to be solved. And yes, Benoit Blanc is the detective played in that three movie series. So I've very much written, because I come from an acting background, I very much write with acting in mind. My scenes are very much theatrically laid out, and the dialogue is hopefully theatrical. So could it transfer? Well, it's a locked room mystery, so it could very easily. It's a couple of locations. So it wouldn't be complicated to put it onto the stage.
Well, then maybe, again, if you've got this time, maybe working on a manuscript of a play, taking the book and turning it into a script.
I would love to do that. I think that'd be a fascinating exercise. It's 97,000 words. So there's a lot that you would have to pare down, which is not a particular skill that I do have, but I'm sure I could work with playwrights who've done that. But I think the only justifiable reason for doing that is if it's a success in novel form.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So if it becomes a success in novel form, then I think I could justify trying to turn it into a play.
Mm.
But to condense it down, so the audio book, which is out, which is absolutely fantastic, it's read by a lovely lady called Kate Walsh, who reads the shipping forecast on the BBC in England. I don't know if you know anybody who's English or anyone who knows the English quirks of English people, they'll know what the shipping forecast is. It's a very odd it's a weather forecast, actually, for you. And she reads out, she's got this beautiful voice. It's the kind of voice that you're listen to during the evening and you've got a glass of wine. And she does the audiobook, but it's about 11 hours long.
Oh, wow.
So to take that and put that into a 90-minute, two-hour play would be a challenge. There'd be lots of my favourite little bits.
I'd have to just
cut them out. It'd break my heart to take some of these characters and go, I can't get you on the stage or into the fight. I would be absolutely brokenhearted. Mm. All my darlings, as people call them.
Now, paint a picture for us of where your favourite place to write is. Do you have a go-to place that you sit and write?
I do now. So I'm very, very lucky in that when we lived in Japan, through quirks of the massive property crash that happened in Japan in the late 1980s, property outside of Tokyo is ridiculously cheap. So you can get really beautiful. We have a 100-square-meter apartment, which is right on the side of a hill, and we bought it for about 15,000 New Zealand dollars because it was empty. And there's lots and lots of these apartments that were built in boomtown in Japan. And the view looks out onto the ski slope.
Oh, wow.
So I can sit there and I have a glass of wine. I can't ski because I have bad knees. I used to ski a lot, but I can't ski anymore. My wife and my two kids will go out and skiing, and all our friends will go out skiing. And I'll sit there with a glass of wine and I'm just looking out at this immaculate snowscape. There is 18 meters of snow, which is extraordinary.
So how did you transfer that here to New Zealand? What have you got now that you're writing?
Well, so now, I mean, this is the thing. In New Zealand, the one thing you're not short on is extraordinary views. Mm. So I now live on the North Shore. I live in Mairangi Bay. And actually, the two things you have, extraordinary views and really big hills. So we're at the top of a really big hill, and I can sit in our front window, and I look out at the ocean, and it's just amazing. So we look out towards Rangitoto, then the Coromandel, and then on a clear day you can kind of see past the Coromandel, and I mean, I don't know what's out there. I mean, here be whales. You'd probably find Peru.
I would probably actually find that distracting, because I could quite easily just sit there and watch container ships come and go and watch out for the cruise ships.
No, it's true. It's true, but I turn my desk away from the view.
Nice.
The trick is to turn your desk away from the view, and then when you've got to a particularly sticky plot point, or you need some inspiration, I just look over my shoulder and I stare out at the view, and it's a wonderful thing. So I've been very, very lucky. Nature is for me, it's much more inspiring to be looking at nature than it is to be in a city. A lot of people work in coffee shops. Mm. That's kind of romantic, but I much prefer to have an expansive view. I think much better when my mind is kind of emptied by just looking at a snowscape.
I love that.
Or a seascape. And it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And things come to you. If you just relax, look at the view, and try not to consciously answer the problem that you're faced with, all of a sudden something will just pop up, and then you can just get back to the writing again.
Oh, I love that. And tell me, if we were to, this is going to sound like a stalker or maybe a mystery, but if I was to sneak into your house,
yes,
who might I find sitting on your bedside table? And I don't mean a person, I mean what books? What authors?
Well, actually, at the moment, you're going to find this one, because I've been reading it cover to cover just to make sure that there's no issues in the printed version of it. What else is on there on the side of the table? I've got a big stack of books. I think One of Us is Lying. My daughter bought me that because she'd seen the TV show. And actually, I went to see a show last night, which I'm not going to say the name, because it involves... it's at the Bruce Mason Centre. It's an Australian comedy duo, and it's a play on inefficient business meetings, and I can't say the word because it involved me swearing on the air, which I'm not going to do. But I bought their book, which is very funny, so that's actually sitting there at the moment as well. But I'm a big audiobook listener.
Right.
So I've physically read maybe half a dozen books in the last year, but I've listened to, I don't know, 150. So,
and do you listen to them while you're travelling, or do you find yourself a comfy little chair looking at your view and listen?
All of the above.
Right.
All of the above. I'll listen to them when I'm doing the housework, because I'm staying. Mm-hmm. So when I'm not working, I'll be listening to an audiobook. I love the creativity that now goes into audiobooks. It's not simply somebody telling you the story, but they're acting it out. And even beyond that, now you get multi-character performances from these audiobooks.
Oh, I love that.
And they're fantastic. They're absolutely wonderful.
Mm.
So that's really where my reading, I mean, that's a debate. Is it reading? I don't know. But that's where how I consume my literature, is through audiobooks.
And are there any future productions and you acting on the horizon?
I would love to. So one of my great regrets is that Shoreside last year did And Then There Were None,
mm-hmm.
which is one of my absolute gold standard books, because that is my inspiration for 90% of what I try and do. But I, just before they started casting that, I had a very bad accident with my back. So I was an invalid basically for most of last year, so I couldn't perform in it, and I was heartbroken. But they will start deciding what their production is again this year, and I would love to be, if they'll have me back, I'd love to be a part of that again. I really, really enjoyed the Pump House and the community theatre and the atmosphere around it. They're wonderful shows.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So tell us then, where can people get hold of this book? As you've said, it's not officially out.
No, it's a funny thing in the world these days. When I was working with my publicist and the distributor, Nationwide Distributors, I said, okay, let's go for a date, the 23rd of February. after Christmas, so I don't get lost in the Christmas rush. People may notice it. I may be able to get on shows like yours. But because of the way that the internet works and because of the way the distribution model work, I realize it's already out in place. But they can get it in all bookshops. It is available in all bookshops. It may not be immediately stocked, but I know that certainly in Auckland, the Book Lover bookshop in Milford, which is one of my favourite local bookshops, and Unity Books in Auckland, they are stocking copies at the moment. But if you go into any of the bookshops, it's all on their databases and can be ordered, even if it's not on the shelves. And as I say, the audiobook is everywhere you look on the internet, which I'm particularly proud of. I think it's lovely.
How does it feel when you walk into a bookshop and see your book sitting on a shelf?
A relief, actually, is the main thing.
Because it's arrived?
Well, because it takes an enormous amount of work. It's 2 years of writing, editing and decision making. The conceiving the story is actually the simple thing. Writing the words down is the easy bit. Getting down 90,000, 100,000 words is the simple bit. And then you have to start taking away and editing. So it's a relief. But I have always loved bookshops. I just walk into them and you can breathe them in. You know you're in a bookshop. If you blindfolded me, I'd know I was in a bookshop. You can smell them.
There's nothing like
it's a
turning pages in a new book.
Oh, it's just a beautiful experience. So it makes me extremely proud to see something on the shelf that I've put my heart and soul into for a number of years now. Yep.
Well, we hope all goes well with the official release, even though it's kind of already there.
It's kind of exactly.
But do stay in touch with us. Let us know how 9 months of empty, in 9 months' time, how you go with empty nesting, or when this second book comes out, all about our pet hound.
I'll be knocking on your door in about 18 months' time when the next one is coming out.
How exciting. Well, thank you so much for coming in on a Sunday night. Listeners, you can't see how beautifully kitted out we are tonight with the most gorgeous boots, which I fell in love with straight away. But thank you so much for coming out, and I'm looking forward to, maybe I need to just get the audio book and I can listen while I'm driving to the North Shore each week when I'm teaching.
Oh, well, that would be lovely. You must let me know what you think.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for your time.
No worries.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And now we're going to listen to another past guest on the show. It's Borderline, who have brought out a new track, and this is Tainted.
You're the best. Hate to say it, I'm a little obsessed. In that dress, out of breath. Now it's gone, I feel a little bit vexed. So I park up the car and I take it too far and say, I don't love you. I wasn't asking for your love. I was wasted. Why did you have to sober up and leave us tainted? When I went through, when I took you down, I went through whatever you wanted. Take it real far. Oh, I never thought that I'd be telling you this. Oh, I never thought that would be your last kiss. So I park up the car and I take it too far and say, oh, I don't love you. I wasn't asking for your love. I was wasted. Why did you have to show me? love. Leave us tainted. What I would do for an object done. I would do whatever you wanted. What I would do for an object done. I would do whatever you wanted.
And that was Borderline with Tainted. Now, I was really excited this week because I got to jump online and do a pre-record with a couple of friends from overseas.
Well, now I'm thrilled to be joined from the other side of the world, literally, all the way zooming in from America is our friend Josh Thacker. How are you?
Oh my gosh, Emma, I am so honored you asked me to do this. I'm good. I'm so happy to see your face and to be speaking with you.
Yeah, so for our listeners who are wondering, who is this person with the really strong American accent? Tell us. That's you, yeah? So tell us, who are you?
Who am I is such a great question. Well, I am a choreographer, a director, a teaching artist. I live in New York City. I'm so grateful to get to do that. And I make theater and I work with young people. I work with older people. And it's my mission. I've bestowed the mission upon myself to elevate the theatrical experience on stage and off. So I do all kinds of work, and I got to meet you so lovingly at the Junior Theater Festival West, which was already, what, like 2-3 weeks ago now?
Yeah, crazy.
And I got to adjudicate your students who blew us away, and I believe got Excellence in Pod, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, like, yep.
Yes, because they were so fantastic, and really had a lovely time, and you and I obviously got on like wildfire. And now I get to see you and speak to you again, and I'm so happy.
Yeah. So tell us, have you always lived in New York City, or where did you hail from?
Oh, gosh, no. So I am from a state called Indiana, which is in the middle of the country. If you know where Chicago is, I'm speaking to the lovely Kiwis who may or may not know American geography, but I'm essentially from the Midwest. So,
of course, Indiana is where 13 the musical set, right?
It is. It's also where a large portion of The Prom takes place, which is really important to me and my trajectory in my life. But yes, Indiana is that place. We are next to Illinois, which you might know, Chicago, the famous city, yep. And we're below Michigan. Like Detroit is not far from where I'm from and places like that.
So Where did kind of the dancing and the theater stuff come from? Did it start in Indiana?
It did. Oh, it absolutely did. It honestly started from, I would say, my mom. She is an amazing human and such a punk rock person. And she wanted to take hip hop as like, a 30, 40 something woman. And she's like, it just sounds fun. And I think it was very clear, like, I was not going to be an athlete. I did not want to hit a bat or throw a ball or things like that. And so she went to this dance studio and she said, I have this little son and he's into gymnastics. And the studio owner was like, please, we would love to have a boy. And here I am 25 years later. And I'm still dancing and I love the theater. So I came into it through dance. I was a competition kid. I don't know if you have that in New Zealand, but like really intense, like conservatory technical training, and then we would compete on weekends. And then at my school, my academic school, we had a fantastic theater program where the drama teacher kind of took me under her wing. And I'll never forget, in fifth grade, I did the musical for the first time. And then after the week after the musical, I marched into her room and I said, I want to choreograph the musical next year. Like this little fifth grader. And she was like, oh. She's like, well, why don't we talk about it next year? And I was like, okay. So then next year rolled around. I was like, I want to choreograph the musical. And I think she really thought that I was insane. And so she said, she like gave me a number and I didn't completely ruin it. And then I think she was like, oh, like he's serious and he's like not awful at this. So then she gave me another number and I choreographed every musical from sixth grade until I graduated.
Crazy.
Craziness.
And then what was the journey then from the end of college through to being now in New York? Like what took you to New York?
Well, so I moved to New York actually for college. I went to New York University, the Tisch School of the Arts is where I got my undergraduate education. And I'm happy I did. It kind of was a nice buffer of moving to New York. Moving to New York, as one might imagine, can be very overwhelming. And it was nice to move there in the context of school and to really get my life together, for those 3 years. And so then I was in New York and, you know, I've left a lot for work and I've traveled a lot and I've been so fortunate to work a lot of places. But I've called New York home now for almost 13 years, which is insane.
Yeah. Especially like for Kiwis, being there a few weeks ago and the weather, I couldn't get over how much snow was on the side of the roads and it was freezing. You almost lost your lips. And I know it's not like that always.
You came probably during the worst time of the, I mean, not the worst time of the year, but the cold, that is the coldest weather I would say we have had continuously for a long time. Like this is easily one of, if not the most intense winter we've had in a very, very long time.
Crazy.
I know. No, but then in the summer it is hot. I mean, it is like you are begging for that weather. It is so unbearably hot sometimes.
Crazy. So tell me, what are you working on at the moment?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Let me see if I can explain this coherently. So I am working on a piece of theater called The Circuit, which is an immersive silent disco ballet, which is a lot of words. There's this really old play called La Ronde. And if you have some deep musical theater fans, you might know a musical by John Michael Lacusa called Hello Again, which is its own sort of thing. But it's essentially a series of vignettes about people and they have an interaction. And in the original play, the interactions are all pretty sexual. But in our play, we are translating it into the year of our Lord, 2026, and we are setting it modern day, and we are transcribing it essentially to music. So the audience and the performers are all going to have silent disco headphones on, and we are performing it in Brooklyn, and that is very quickly coming up. I'm co-directing, choreographing, conceiving. It is in many ways kind of my baby, along with my many, many collaborators. But that is kind of the big project at this current moment, which is insane.
Yeah. So how many people on stage in that?
We are currently working with a company of about six on stage, for multiple reasons. And you know, a lot of duets and a lot of pairings off and things of that nature. But it is, I am very excited about the potential. It could be a complete disaster, but it is, there are a lot of ideas and qualities, that I'm really excited about. And first of all, I love to dance, like in the academic sense, but I also love to dance in the recreational sense. And I've always been fascinated of like, how can you merge these two worlds in some way? And I think this is like my first real foray into exploring what that could be.
Now, with the silent disco, with the audience having headphones on, are they like stationary in seats, or how does the audience interact?
So it's a traveling show. So it's going to travel from location to location, which is also something that makes it really exciting. I'm thinking of it almost as like a little adventure for the audience and the actors. I don't know if you know, like the show Sleep No More, or if you're listening, but it's an immersive experience where you truly like enter a world. Or actually there's even a better example, in New York City right now, there's a brand new production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera called Masquerade, where it takes place like immersively. So you literally walk through the opera house and onto the roof and all this stuff. We are doing what we're calling sort of the poor man's version of that. But it literally puts the audience into the action in a lot of ways, which to us is very exciting.
So tell me, how, kind of jumping backwards a little bit, but how did you get scouted for or found for being a part of Junior Theatre Festival?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I had just closed the prom national tour. I was the dance captain. That was and continues to be one of the highlights of my life and my career. An ex-boyfriend of mine, he had done a show with Tim McDonald, and Tim brought the company of that show to JTF. And my ex-boyfriend was like, well, this is like your domain. Like you'd be great at this. You would love this. And I was like, oh my God, I'd love to. And luckily the wonderful people at JTF took a chance on me. And as Gianna, our friend, said, she's like, oh, you fit. Like I love everything about JTF. I love working with young people, especially in New York and in the grind of the professional life. It can be so refilling and so inspiring to see just creativity and joy unleashed in that way. And it truly becomes one of my favorite things. I love it. But that I literally got in through a friend, and now I'm hoping I never get to leave.
And I think that's the thing with theatre too, though, isn't it? So much of theatre is actually about the network, and it is about who you know and those doors being opened. Like, it's quite often not actually about your talent, right? I mean, your talent's important. But
I mean, I think, you know, in every level of it, like, we've all seen theater that we thought wasn't so great, and we've all seen theater that was incredible. And in all of those cases, it really, all that piece of theater had to start with two people having a conversation. And so what I'm learning, especially at this phase of my life, is you have to really put yourself out there. You know, I've been an actor for a long time, but I'm focusing more and more on being a director, being a choreographer, of being part of the creative team. And that is truly, I mean, it's like selling a car. I mean, you're like, you're trying to get a meeting. You're trying to get your ideas in front of people who have enough money to maybe make them come true. You have to get other people excited about what you're doing to help you make that happen. And it's so much more random and like scatterbrained, I think, then people realize. Like, yes, there is a pedigree of people, and obviously at the true Broadway level, there are names and people who are always probably at the top of the list. But I think something I've really learned is you really have to open your mouth to say, I think I could do a great job at this, and here's why. It's a little, and I think that is also true for people on stage. It comes from a little different place because you probably have auditions or you might know people. But it is truly, I mean, almost all of the jobs I've had in the past 3 years have been phone calls. I have not, I think I can think of two jobs that I have booked that were auditions from basically since I finished that tour, which is both awesome and fascinating.
Yeah. So being a dance captain on a national tour,
yes.
What was that like? Like, obviously, it's different to just being one of the performers.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the key things maybe a dance captain has to do? Like, what are the extra responsibilities?
Totally. So if you don't know, a dance captain is kind of the liaison or the bridge between the creative team and the cast. So between, in this case, the choreographer, director, and the performers. And basically, it was my job, along with my incredible co-dance captain, Lexi Plath, to keep the show running and to keep the show as strong and tight and powerful as it was the night we opened until the night we closed. And when you are doing that across different states, different cities for a year, you know, that job can become increasingly more difficult. So I had to teach new people the show. We had, I think, about 6 or 7 people leave us during the run of the tour, which is common. People book other things or move on. So we have to teach someone the entire show in about 2 to 3 days. We would have brush up rehearsals if things were not going well, or if things were getting sloppy, or if something had changed and someone was feeling unsafe. We had to clean that up. We ran understudy rehearsal. So we had all, you know, all these swings and covers who need a chance to rehearse. The biggest thing we had to do was essentially figure out a cut track or a split show. That tour was still kind of in the breath of COVID. We all remember and miss her, not really. A lot of times, you know, one person calls out, two people call out, three people call out, and all of a sudden you now have a show that usually has 27 people, and now you have to do it with 21 people. So you go through and you figure out, like, who's going to strike this set piece, and who's going to stand on zero today, and are you going to have a different partner tonight, and who's going to say these lines? I was not technically a swing. A swing is someone who covers multiple other roles, but we only had two swings, so I was sort of the third unofficial swing. I'll never forget, I was in Los Angeles, and I was in the shower at half hour, you know, half hour to curtain, and there's two sort of featured ensemble boys who do like a vocal thing, and they have a little arc and whatever. I was in the shower because the power had gone out at the place I was staying the night before. So it had been a rough night. And then I get out of the shower and my stage manager was like, "So we don't have a Nick or a Kevin. Who do you want to be?" And I was like, "What?" And I was like, "I haven't rehearsed either." And I was like, I need to be Nick. I was like, "I know Nick better, and like I can feel more comfortable singing that." And so literally I was like, I need like 2 minutes in a rehearsal room with the music director. We like ran upstairs. I think I'm still like in my robe. And then I just like, we go and you do the show. I mean, it's crazy stuff like that. It's a lot of like people managing and safety and ensuring basically like quality control, ensuring that the show that people are paying to see is the show that the creatives want the people to see.
That's crazy. So does that mean that, like, when you move, is the dance captain a big part of putting it onto the stage, like new spacing or things like that? Or does when you go to a new stage or a new theatre, does the choreographer come back to do that? Or who does the restaging of it?
That's the dance captain. So if you're lucky, how it works in America is, especially for a tour, Broadway can be a little different, but for a tour, after opening night, like the creative team is done. The director, the choreographer, they have other projects, or really in essence, the producers are done paying them, is how it works. So they go away and you have a dance captain. We were lucky in that our set fit. If memory serves me, there were not any venues where like our set didn't fit. It is not uncommon for people to book a venue and then realize that like their set doesn't fit. Like I have friends who did like a Wizard of Oz tour years ago, and they were like, "We couldn't fit the house on stage." They're like, "It's a play that kind of needs a house, but we had to do it without a house." So in that case, yes, it would have been the dance captain's responsibility to restage or be like, "Sorry, Emma, you're on the end, and we just like literally can't fit you on the stage tonight. So,
go into the dressing room. See you later.
You're not doing this number tonight," or something like that. But yeah, I love it. I also, when I was dance captain, I got to run a lot of workshops and work with a lot of kids all across the country and thespian groups, and talk about the show and talk about dance, and I loved it. It was the perfect hybrid of everything I love to do, which is work with professionals and teach at the same time. And I loved it.
So have you got a dream show that if you could do, like, have you got the biggest bucket list?
As a performer, as a choreographer, or
either. If I was to say to you right now, I have an open-ended check of money, a bank account with anything, and you could do anything you wanted, what would that be? So in New Zealand, we have an arts foundation called Creative New Zealand, and they're meant to give money to upcoming. So if you could do your dream project.
My gut, which is usually the good sign, is Andrew Lipa's Wild Party. I don't know if you or your listeners would, but that show has the most fascinating history and trajectory. And I know that, I don't know Andrew Lippa personally, but I know that he has like feelings about it and all this stuff. But I think there is something so intoxicating about that piece, and I would love to get my hands on it.
Producers out there, if you're listening, if
would love to do it. Love
party, I know that Josh would be happy to fly to the other side of the world. Tell me, when I say New Zealand, what do you think? Like, what do Americans think New Zealand is?
Amazing, sweet, a nice island that exists in harmony, far away from us, and we yearn to get there. Someone once referred to it as the Long Island of Australia. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but I was
New Zealand and Australia have a little bit often rivalries, kind of a little bit similar to if I said you that America is actually the Long Island of Canada.
Oh, okay. So that's derogatory. Okay. All right. Okay. Good to know. I am trying to think. I have one friend who I have not seen in probably 10 years who moved to New Zealand. And that is like about as close of a personal connection, other than now getting to know you and getting to work with your students, that I have. I think of it as tropical. Is it tropical?
No. Sorry.
Well, darn.
I mean, the Pacific Islands between us and Australia, you know, Fiji and those, you know, Samoa, they're a bit more tropical. And depending when you come and depending where in New Zealand you go, you know, like there's hot and cold. Today's a bit cloudy and a bit yuck, but we're okay. But, you know, we're going to work to get you down to this end of the country.
Yes,
the world.
We must.
Yeah.
We must.
Now, I've got one last question for you. We have this kick-arts question that we often ask people. So if you could go back to your 16-year-old self.
Oh, I love this.
What would you tell them?
Gosh. Yes. I would tell them, take a little more time. Stop stressing so much and truly trust the journey and trust the process. There will be things you really want that don't happen, but the things that are meant to happen will happen. I do believe that in thinking through my journey. And it's obviously very easy for me to say that because I have been fortunate and have checked boxes, and there are still plenty of boxes I have not checked that I'm still like chomping at the bit. But to a 16-year-old myself, and I was high strung, like I was like giving CEO 16-year-old, is just to, you don't always have to be the best. You just have to share what you have.
I have
one of my teachers, I'll share this one last little bit. Randy Graff, I don't know if that's a name that means anything. She's a Tony winner for City of Angels. She's a legend. She's an icon. I love this woman so much. She would always say in class, she said, nothing to prove, only to share.
Oh, and that's it.
And I think that is true for every single artist in any medium, especially theater. Like, you have nothing to prove, only to share. Doesn't mean it's going to be perfect. Doesn't mean it's going to be the best, but it is what you have to offer. And if you are brave enough to offer it, they should be fortunate enough to receive it.
I love that. Well, we wish you all the best for your silent disco ballet and look forward to catching up with you in the future to find out what's happening on the other side of the world. Hopefully next time, you know, later in the year, we can catch up with you. You might even be down here. Maybe you'll end up in our studio and do a live interview.
Who knows?
Thank you so much for helping us kick some arts.
Wow. Well, that was Josh all the way from the other side of the world. He choreographed in a workshop for us as well with our Kiwi All-Stars, and what a phenomenal guy. And we truly hope that we can get him down here to this side of the world for maybe the 10th anniversary of Junior Theatre Festival New Zealand. Now, today is the 15th anniversary of the February 22nd Christchurch earthquakes. Pretty devastating time for New Zealand, with 185 people lost at that time. But today we're also celebrating, though, that there's a new Hummingbird Coffee Partnership, part of the Springboard Awards. And this particular one is a $25,000 Springboard Award that remembers how creativity helped Otatahi find its footing in the wake of the 2011 earthquakes. Now, soon after the earthquakes, Hummingbird Coffee established a pop-up cafe in the Restart Container Mall, helping to revive the inner city. And not only did they do that, they then created the Restart Coffee Blend, which the money from that contributed to the rebuild of the Court Theatre. So the recipients of this year's Springboard Awards are still in deliberation. Entries have closed, nominations have closed, and we'll talk more about that next month when they are announced. But I just wanted to give a massive shout out to whānau, friends, people who were affected by that earthquake, especially big shout out to Stephen, who of course was down there on that day and has an amazing story to tell about the day, and his guardian angel who looked after him to make sure he is still here now. So sending love to all the Cantabrians, all the whānau, everyone affected. Kia kaha, stay strong. And it's so beautiful to see the arts flourishing down there. Now, we've got another amazing interview from the other side of the world. Here we go. So it's so exciting because now I've got a second guest who's also currently sitting in America. And as you know, listeners, I was sitting there a few weeks ago. So it's really surreal to be sitting here in little old Aotearoa. And I'm currently looking at the most gorgeous face beaming in all the way from Kentucky. It's Darian Sanders. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Yourself?
Oh, great. And it's so exciting to see your face. Now tell us, your list of what you have done is so massive. You know, you're a missionary and with your mission through your faith in God. You're a national actor on national tours. You've played iconic roles. You sing national anthems. And now you decided to add to the list. You're now a published author. Like,
yes.
This is crazy.
Why stop, you know, at one thing when you can just do so many?
Very true. So tell us, let's roll it. Right back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Where did a passion for the arts come from?
I was born with it. I grew up in a musical family, so my entire family played some kind of instrument. So I grew up watching and being a part of the band world. And in the fourth grade, I was sitting at my brother and sister's band practice, and I was sitting on the fence, and there was a lady up in this tower, and she was screaming down on this field, and then she'd go down the field and work with the kids, and then she'd go back up to the tower. And it went from this like ugly looking sounding mess to this beautiful tapestry and orchestral sound on the field. And I was like, that's what I want to do with my life. And so in the fourth grade, I decided I wanted to be a high school band director. So I told my parents, I went to a garage sale, bought a trumpet for $400, and I started my journey. So in Kentucky, in the United States, I couldn't start band until fifth grade. And so I just picked up this horn and made some sounds and tried to do what I could until I had to wait a year until I could actually be in classes and learn how to play the trumpet. And so that's where it started for me. But it grew into this like love and passion of music and of the arts and being able to see and experience different things and going to Governor's School for the Arts in my junior year of high school, which was this summer intensive program, almost like Interlochen, where it's Kentucky-based, but it's all these different art forms. So you had creative arts, you had writing, you had dancing, you had theater, you had music, you had band, you had orchestra. And we just got together at this university and had this conglomeration of hearts and minds. And then from there, just put on a performance at the end of the week.
So at that time, was it more the playing, or when you went to that weekend, were you kind of thinking that singing and performing was you, or was it just more the trumpet?
It was trumpet all the way. So I didn't start to think about theater and even get introduced truly to theater until I was in college. And post-college, actually, I was singing the national anthem at a basketball game, and my now manager saw me singing. And she went back up to New York and was talking to her client, who happened to be Matilda on Broadway, and was like, hey, this kid was, and started explaining who I was. And they were like, you're actually talking about Darian. He's our worship pastor at church. And so they connected us, and she was like, hey, have you ever thought about theater? And I was like, well, I don't dance. I don't act. I only sing in church. I don't have any training. But she's like, it doesn't matter. Like, you have this X factor, you have this it factor that I think the theater world needs, and this spark that just lights up this entire arena, and I think that it would light up a Broadway stage.
So how did you get to even sing the national anthem where this person saw you?
So it was like when American Idol was at its highest point. And so the University of Kentucky, the big university where I was living, they said, hey, we want to do a UK Idol, their version of American Idol. And so it was at a volleyball game, and I won that volleyball game, American Idol, and that's what got me to sing the national anthem at a basketball game.
Crazy. So, and since then, you've continued singing at sports matches. What's been a favorite? Have you got a is it singing for your own team, or is it something bigger?
Yes and no. Like, it's one of those things of, like, getting to sing for the home team is awesome and great, but I've just gotten some cool opportunities for MLB, for NBA. I actually just got back from Los Angeles, where I got to sing for All-Star Week. They had asked me to come out and sing for All-Star Week, which they had three games that entire week, and then All-Star Weekend with the All-Star Games, dunk contest, three-point contest, all those things. So I get to sing for the Lakers-Spurs game out there. Got to sing for the playoffs.
So tell me, when it comes to singing at these games, have you had, like, because is the majority of the time you're singing a cappella?
Yeah. So it's all a cappella. That's what I do. The cool part about it is I'm gearing up because I want to sing at the Super Bowl one day, or NBA playoffs for championship game. And so for me, I think about it and I look at the Super Bowl and how they have the orchestration and all those things. So using in-ears and those kind of things, they just help with the reverb. So like I've sang some national anthems at football games and there's like a 6 second delay. And so you start to sing and then all of a sudden you hear yourself back. And so making sure that you're geared up and ready to go and, making sure that those things aren't distractions for you is really good.
Have you ever had any issues like you've started in the wrong key and suddenly realized that you're singing too high? Or
no, thankfully, I knock on wood, we're good. I've sang quite a bit, national anthems, but I've never had any mishaps, and hopefully will not. I have a pretty wide range in my vocal range, so there isn't really too high for me that I found, so that's kind of good.
So tell me then, after that freak finding, you know, the producer saying, oh, he's my minister, you know, he's part of our worship team, etc., what came first? Was your first Broadway thing or your first national tour Lion King, or was there something before that?
So there was a community theater and regional theater before. So she asked me to do she was producing a Broadway review at the University of Kentucky in the summer, which is basically a community show that they put a conglomeration of like all these different Broadway songs together. So they would take one song from the Book of Mormon and then one song from Hamilton, one song from Les Mis. And it would just be like, okay, somebody would do a solo or a trio or a group number. and she'd asked me to be a part of that. So I was like, okay. And I joined that, and that was like the first introductory to the stage and performing. Quick changes, songs, rehearsals, all those things. And after that, the choreographers of that show, Lindy Franklin Smith and Jeremy Smith, were opening up their own equity production company, regional production company in Kentucky. And so they contacted me, and they wanted me to be a part of launching this company for them, because for them, they said, we want to bring Broadway caliber shows to Kentucky. And so we want to use today's Broadway stars that are on Broadway right now that are doing the thing, and tomorrow's Broadway hopefuls. So like up and coming community, local talent, and college kids from around the country. And we want to put on these Broadway caliber shows. And so they brought us all together, and we launched this theater company in January of 2015, which was pretty awesome, because I actually got to do the show with Mara DeVee, Laura Bell Bundy, and Jonathan Groff. And I got to sing a solo and duet with Jonathan. We did Hair from the musical Hair, and it was so fun. So like, I got to sing a solo and duet, and that was like the start of it all, and performing with him, and him encouraging me and saying, man, you could be in New York doing this right now on a Broadway stage, and you need to be pursuing this, is what kind of launched and catapulted me into then going to different community and regional theaters and auditioning for Hairspray and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoats, and then getting precast as Jesus and Jesus Christ Superstar and doing Dreamgirls. And so I did all these things in this regional community theater that kind of got my blood going in excitement for theater. And then I was able to do like Legally Blonde, Newsies, Music Man in this regional theater to earn EMC points to then all of a sudden get encouraged to then want to go and audition for like Hamilton and The Lion King.
Crazy. And Lion King was 5 years that you were in?
I did it for 5 years. So I started out in the ensemble, and then I actually tore my meniscus and had to leave and get it repaired. And the pandemic was a little bit of that time, which was awesome because I was able to recover and recoup. And then post-pandemic, they asked me to come back full-time as Simba. And so I performed 3 years full-time as Simba.
What was your biggest challenge being in a tour like that, or that length of time, or what was the biggest challenge?
I would say being away from the family. I'm married and have a little boy. He was 2 at the time when I started. And so me being gone and coming back and forth was easy. But post-pandemic, he was a little bit older and kind of realized. So, like, thankfully, and we talked and processed through this, like, thankfully, you know, we have, you know, friends and family and other people that we know that, you know, have gone off to war or like have traveling jobs or other things like that. And they're not able to FaceTime as we are, talk on the phone. And so we had that ability to FaceTime and talk on the phone. I had the ability to be off of work on Mondays for our golden days. So I would fly home and be home with my family on Mondays, or they would fly out and be on tour with me for a couple weeks in different cities. And so, that was probably the hardest part, but, I don't know. In that season, we kind of made it work.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I suppose, like you said, it's not like the olden days when you would have had to have communicated with him via writing a letter, which he wouldn't have got for a week. Like, literally, if something happens, you can pick up the phone and he's there.
He's right there. And I think about like traveling salesmen or people that had to get on trains to travel and this, that, or the other. Like, It's a glorious thing that I can get on a plane after a show on a Sunday or a Monday morning, be home by lunchtime. I can hang out with them all day. And then Tuesday, we have breakfast together. Then they take me to an airport. I get on a plane, and then I'm able to perform Tuesday night at 7:30 in front of 3,000 people.
Crazy. If you had to give a tip to a young up-and-coming about maybe staying, you know, getting involved, or a piece of advice to someone, have you got, what would you say?
Two things. One, actually three things. One, take lessons. Singing, acting, dancing, the whole bit. So even though I was on a Broadway stage, even though I'm still a Broadway performer, I still take lessons. And even when I had the role of the number one guy in the number one musical of the world, I still was taking lessons because we can always hone our skill and get better. Every audience that we sit in front of is a new audience, and so therefore we owe it to them to bring something special and unique and beautiful. And so making sure that our skill set and our skill level is up to par at all points in time. Two is don't take yourself out of the game. It's okay to know and understand that maybe you may be wanting to do something that you feel is out of your range of skill set. It's okay. It's scary. Do it anyways. Like it's one of those things that I was a worship pastor for 16 years, and all of a sudden I started Broadway at 33. It's a young man's game if you think about it, where people start at a very young age singing and dancing and taking lessons, and then they go to community theater, and then they go to college, and then they go to New York, and they hit the grind and do all these things. So my unconventional way was my journey and my path. But if I was scared and chose not to do it and took myself out before I even started, I wouldn't be in the spot that I am and have the opportunities that I do. And lastly, the last piece of advice is know and understand that your journey is your journey. Like, you are unique and special. You are qualified because it's your life and you have lived this moment, and no one can tell you and say to you, you're not qualified to do the things that you're doing. And no one understand, like, your story and your skill set is specifically something only you can bring to the table. No one else can tell a better story than Darian can tell Darian's story. No one else has lived my life better than me, so therefore, I have that right and the ability to give it to the world.
I love that. And your beautiful book, Don't Fear Your Roar, I mean, that's pretty much what you just said then, is kind of the book in a nutshell, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
go out and do it, and don't be scared.
No. So many people have limiting beliefs, and I'd say they take themselves out of the game before the game even starts. And everyone's like, man, you have more than 24 hours in a day, or man, you have so many skill sets, and man, you can do this and this and this. And it's like, yeah, I can, but you can too. I just choose not to settle. And I have a solid support system with my wife and my boy that allow me to do some things that are pretty awesome and pretty cool.
So what led you to decide to write it down?
Honestly, I was challenged by one of my friends. I was out in LA and he was telling me about sharing my story, and I was like, no one wants to hear my story. And he's like, what do you mean no one wants to hear your story? And so I started explaining a little bit, and we were sitting at a red carpet event, and this girl was standing in the red carpet event line with us to get ready to go into this event. And she was like, I'd buy that book. I love that story. I would do that. And I'm like, oh, maybe somebody that has no clue who I am, maybe they would want to hear that. And then from there, it turned into, man, I can take my story and use my story to maybe encourage somebody else to jump into their journey, and for them to feel and understand that they have a roar that people need to hear as well.
Yeah, and I love the way that your book is written. Like, listening to you talking now is how it is replicated on the page. Like, it's so Darian.
It was very intentional that way. So many people were like, "Man, I zipped through that book, and it was just like I was having a conversation with you." And I said, "I wrote it specifically that way because I am not a huge reader. I don't like to read a lot of books. I love to do Audible and listen. But also this aspect of I don't want some heady, wordy, like in the clouds conversation. I just love just having real, authentic, genuine community and real conversation. So the same way that you were like, hey, we're going to talk and we're going to have some conversations, like this isn't a like scripted conversation, is the same way that I wanted the book to feel and be, as if you were sitting in the car with me, we were going on a road trip, you asked me my story, I shared it, and then maybe I challenged you a little bit with my story for yourself to say, man, have you limited yourself in any way? And if you have, why? Why don't you just go for it? You want a new job? Go for it. You're dreaming about doing this? Do it. What's stopping you?
That is so cool. Now, you and I met through the amazing International Junior Theatre Festival a number of years ago now. So can you recall the first time you went to JTF?
I can. It was 3 years ago. I had heard about it through Marion Phelps, and she was just, she was a director of mine in a show that I did, and she was telling me about this theater festival, and I was like, I have never heard about this. She was like, I'm going to explain it to you, but I can't explain it to you. She was like, you won't understand and know until you just come in person, but we would love for you to like come and adjudicate and be a part of this and all these things. And when I tell you, I went to JTF Atlanta and it was a whirlwind. I took some time off the Lion King tour and I came to Atlanta, and it blew my mind to see the heart, the passion, the excellence, and just how the productions were put on, to see how the theater, the festival was run. I was like, this is a machine, and you have all of these kids and all of these adults from all these different places. We had people from around the globe, and I was like, what is going on? And I was so shocked, but I was also like, these kids are phenomenal. Like, they're giving me a run for my money, and I'm on this professional stage, and they are trained and trained well. So that even more energized me and excited me to say, man, I got to continue to get back into class and make sure I'm doing the thing that I need to do to make sure that I am up to par.
And it is. I totally agree with you. I think people don't understand what JTF is until you step into, like, the kickoff and the energy and the excitement of the playlist and everyone singing, and then the next second everyone's standing and dancing, and the noise, and but it's beautiful noise. Like, it's so joyful. And I mean, for me as a little old Kiwi, it is actually coming across and standing next to these Broadway stars, and for the Kiwi kids, it's realizing, I think, that it is within their reach, because I think, you know, again, 16-year-old Emma would never have imagined even traveling to America, let alone standing next to Broadway stars and working with them.
Yeah.
Super, super cool. Now, have you ever been down to the Southern Hemisphere?
Not yet, but I will be, I tell you that.
So when you think about New Zealand, what do you envisage or imagine or think? I mean, your interactions with New Zealanders are like with crazy people like me. So what do you think New Zealand's going to be like?
I have no clue. I imagine it is going to be an eclectic conglomeration of beautiful people with amazing hillsides and a great view, phenomenal food, and just like I will say, I'm excited about the people, because everyone that I have met have been so genuinely amazing and welcoming and warm and inviting. I feel like I'm just going to step off the plane and it's going to be like, I'm home. It's just safe and beautiful and like a big warm hug.
I love that.
I'm hoping the weather's great.
Well, yeah, I mean, October's not bad. So, yeah, I mean, that time of the year when we have our festivals, it's not bad, you know. And if you do Australia straight after, well, then you get another step up in the weather when you go across there. So there we go.
If I'm coming, I'm doing both.
I love that. I love that. Now, how can people, if they want to know more about Darian, find out more about you?
I always tell people my website, DarianSanders.com, is one of the best ways, or Instagram, _DarianSanders_.
And I have to plug, I think the best thing they can do is actually get onto Amazon or wherever it is. Where do we get this from?
I love it. Well, we just officially got picked up by Macmillan Distribution, and it is in Barnes & Noble. It is on Amazon. You can get it wherever your local bookstore is, and it's being shipped out to all these different places. But yeah, you can go to Amazon and grab it. You can go to my website and grab it. There's a link on there that you can get it there as well.
That is amazing. Now, the last question before we finish up. If I was to say to you, I have an unlimited amount of money and you can do what ever you want for your next project, whether that be performing or directing or whatever, what would your dream project be?
I'm actually raising funds right now for my movie. So my book got picked up to be adapted into a movie, and so that's what we're working on right now. And it's a whole conglomeration of things, because it's a little bit of my music. We're going to do a soundtrack for it. We have the movie, we have the Audible book, we have the ebook, we have the book tour. So it's like all going on right now. It's all working together to do that. And so I would say it would be that, because eventually, like, I'm going to get an EGOT. So like, if I get, you know, a Tony, a Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, you know, if it's all from the book and from a musical and from my music, let's just do it. Why not?
Now, listeners, I think it's right there. Like, the fact that you have these goals, you're determined, you're passionate, these things can happen, you know, absolutely. And you've just got to channel that I can. So I just think you are so amazing. You've got a fangirl right here.
Well, I stinking love you. Since the moment I met you, you've been absolutely encouraging and supporting. And when I tell you just the talent that you have and what you bring to the table, like, I'm grateful to know you. I'm excited about getting over to New Zealand and seeing you.
We're going to make that happen. Don't you worry. All right. Yes. Well, thank you so much for giving of your time. I hope that tornado doesn't hit down there.
It's already passed.
It's already passed. There we go. Yes. Yay. We love that. So you can leave the basement. And we look forward to keeping up with what's happening in your world. And as you said, hopefully we can have you in studio sometime in person.
Yes. Sounds great.
Wasn't that so cool? Now, I realized at the end I had trimmed out the whole tornado thing that went on in the middle of that, where the sound of thunder went through. You might have heard it a little bit. But anyway, stop talking, Emma. I thought I would play you Darian singing the national anthem. Have a listen to this.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag, it was still there. Say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free in the
Wasn't that crazy? I wasn't going to play the whole thing, but as he went, I just couldn't stop myself. So fingers crossed we can get Darian in studio later this year. Let's see how we go with that. Now, we're coming to the end of our show. It's been a full-on trip back to America for me, not physically, but literally talking to those guys. It was so cool. So thank you so much to Josh and Darian for their time. Thank you to Nick for coming into studio on a Sunday night. Now, don't forget to, if you've got something coming up in the arts, make sure you let us know. We want to talk to you. We want to hear about your journey. We want to hear who inspired you and what you're doing and what you would do if you got a lump sum of money. So book in with us, info@kickarts.org.nz. We also love to play music. So remember, if you've got a neighbour that plays music a lot, maybe incessantly, drop them in. Tell us so that we can contact them maybe and we can play their music here at Kick Arts. Now, Stephen will be back next week with us. So looking forward to that. The Theatre List has just come out as well earlier this evening. So lots coming up, and probably the biggest thing is we've got two big touring shows happening. So one, Rocky Horror Picture Show, opens next week in Auckland before it heads down to Wellington. And Menopause the Musicals also making a comeback with four New Zealand amazing wahine toa. So check that one out for a good night of laughs, along with some local entertainment. It's coming up time for the first round of shows from Dolphin Theatre from Foolish Wit. So we'll talk about them in future weeks. But as I said, if you've got something coming up, let us know so we can chuck it up on our events page as well. Now, tonight, because I've just interviewed Darian, I couldn't go out without a song from him. So here he is with his version of Because You Loved Me. Go out there, have a great week, and make sure you kick some arts.
Times you stood by me, for all the truth that you made me see, for all the joy you brought to my life, for all the wrong that you made right, for every dream you made come true, for all the love I found in you, I'll be forever thankful, baby. You're the one. You're the one who saw me through it all. You were my strength when I was weak. You were my voice when I couldn't speak. You were my eyes when I couldn't see. You saw the best there was in me. Lifted me up when I couldn't reach. You gave me faith cause you believed. I'm everything I am because you loved me. You were always there for me, the tender wind that carried me, the light in the dark, shining your love into my life. You've been my inspiration. Strength when I was weak. You were my voice when I couldn't speak. You were my eyes when I couldn't see. You saw the best there was in me. Lifted me up when I couldn't reach. You gave me faith cause you believed. I'm everything I am because you loved me. You were my strength when I was weak. You were my voice when I couldn't speak. You were my eyes when I couldn't see. You saw the best there was in me. Lifted me up when I couldn't reach. You gave me faith cause you believed. I'm everything I am because you loved me. Thank you.
as you loved me.
We'll see you in a week. Don't forget to brush your teeth and don't forget to go to sleep. We'll be going live, same time under the stars, saying blah, 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 blah. Let's go kick some art, art, art. Go kick some.